The Economic Competitiveness and Education Finance Division will come to order. Today we're going to talk about the Governor's Supplemental Budget Proposal, and we're going to start with the Department of Human Services. And Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about how changes in TANF affects the child care in Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Nelson. I'm a budget director in the Children and Family Services part of the Department of Human Services. Our main areas of activity are in the welfare program, in child welfare, and in the child care program. I'll be working off of two of our budget pages. They look like this, with a dark heading on the top saying human services, and then there's two budget items that I'd like to talk to you about. And these were items that we talked about in subcommittee and did a little description of the administrative items and the TANF items. In terms of our administrative budget reduction, Representative Blawick had asked us just to note that we had a 4% administrative reduction like many other state agencies. It would amount to about a $3.5 million net cut for the Department of Human Services. It would affect all parts of the Department of Human Services, including Children and Family Services. We are in the process of determining just how the cuts would fall. We anticipate that it would include just short of 40 positions that would be reduced, and other savings in items like travel and professional technical contracts. So those are the administrative budget reductions that are in the Department of Human Services budget. Now, of more interest are the TANF-related parts of the budget. A large piece of the governor's proposal is to take the existing TANF balance, which will be roughly $106 million through the end of next biennium, and
Would you say that again?
$106 million through the end of next biennium. And this is a balance that isn't committed under current law. And the governor is proposing that be refinanced. And when we say refinance, we mean that we can swap the general fund that is being used in various areas and swap that for TANF, bring the TANF balance down to zero at the end of the period, but save state general fund over that period in the amount of $106 million. And where it intersects with E-12 education is in the child care area. We are able, through federal law, the allowable uses of TANF funds in federal law, to take TANF and transfer it to the Child Care and Development Block Grant, and then in turn use that Child Care and Development Block Grant on child care. And currently that child care is being funded with the general fund. one of the principles in the DHS budget is that we're not going to reduce current eligibility or services. So this is a pure swap of funds without any effect on the client. If you look on the budget page with the numbers, basically we are going to be taking $25 million out of general fund child care in 08, and then $6 million out in 09, and replacing it with child care and development block grant funds that we've transferred in from the TANF block grant. There are a couple other mechanisms that we also use to refinance TANF that affect DHS programs such as the Children and Community Services block grant. We can refinance TANF into that program, pull out general fund, and similarly with the MFIP program, we can put in TANF funds and pull out general funds. We're able to do this under federal law. There is a considerable balance in the TANF fund, and we can use it to help the state's budget become balanced through the governor's proposal. And I can stand for any questions. You may need some more background on the TANF program, and I can certainly provide you that.
Mr. Nelson, if we weren't making these swaps and we weren't balancing the budget with the TANF, would more families would we be able to offer the TANF funds to more families?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, certainly these funds can be used on program expansions as well. Expansions in the MFIS area, in the child care area, and related services for children and families, because our strategy is to try to keep current benefits and services in the wake of the budget deficit. This seems like a good choice in doing that.
Any other questions about the TANF? All right, Mr. Nelson, then what about these 40 positions that you talked about at the beginning for DHS? Are they 40 child care positions, or are they total DHS positions?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, these are our 40 positions across the entire agency. We haven't specified where those positions might be. Typically, the child care positions are funded with federal funds, so it's less likely that those positions would be affected. But if there are layoffs and some bumping occurs, it could indirectly affect child care positions.
And do you have any, I suppose you don't have any idea of how many children would be affected by the lack of these 40 positions?
Madam Chair, we would be working in making these reductions to make sure that direct services are impacted in the most limited way.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I understand what you're doing here in this transfer and transferring to a block grant and saving general fund dollars, etc. But if we weren't doing that, weren't doing the transfers, what would those TANF dollars be spent on? We're transferring them now to child care. What other services are we excluding, or if any?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, TANF is direct appropriated. So the legislature appropriates every dollar of TANF. And based on the forecast in the MFIP and child care program, we have this surplus of funds available. The funds are not committed to any one purpose until the legislature makes that commitment.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry to be late. I think I've heard you a couple of times already, though. So, Mr. Nelson, the estimate was legislatures in the past, since we've had deficits for a number of years, you put together a chart. I think it was $300 million that's been refinanced approximately. Can you tell us how much that is?
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the TANF block grant started in 1997, and it was a block grant that was the assemblage of what was the old AFDC program, and it was block granted to states. And in the early years, we were underspending the block grant by quite a bit. We get about $265 million a year in TANF funds. And in the early years of the program, there was quite large surpluses, and the legislature ended up refinancing quite a bit of those surpluses through the governor's proposal through the year 2011, we'll have refinanced about $290 million worth of TANF. So roughly, it's about 8% of the block grant that we have received over the course of the dozen or so years that we have received TANF.
Senator, I think what we struggle with is this is actually a permissible use of TANF funds, is it not?
Madam Chair, Representative Slawick, that is correct.
So, Madam Chair and members, the hard part for us as legislators is when we come into deficit years like this and like we have had since a lot of us have been here, is when you can actually use this money in this type of fashion. It's obviously there's a lot of trade-offs involved, but it is permissible under the federal government. It's always been permissible, and do you see it going forward that way or changing to not be permissible to refinance TANF?
Mr. Nelson?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Fawick, child care has always been a critical part of the TANF program, and from the very beginning, there has been allowed a 30% transfer to child care. I don't see that changing because child care will always be a very important part of the TANF program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Appreciate your visit. Department of Education, Commissioner Segrin. The way I read it, the proposal was that there would be 4% cut to your agency, to your department.
Yes, Madam Chair, and thank you for having us this afternoon. The 4% reduction in our state budget would amount to $892,000 each year. That is the equivalent of about 10 to 12 FTEs. We also had the request that the Board of Teaching also reduce their budget by 4%, and that would be the equivalent of $25,000. And also the Board of School Administrators' operating budget would be reduced by $7,000. So those are the three areas that are housed at the Department of Education. We also I do not know at this time. The question was asked where the specific FTE would fall. We will be awaiting for the end of the legislative session to see, you know, what things may happen if we would receive additional mandates to do something that would direct us to have to preserve some staff over other staff. We're hoping that we will be looking at reductions through attrition. If that's happening, we know we have a lot of people that are eligible for retirement, so we may have some retirements that would allow us not to actually go into any kind of a layoff status. We will also be looking at travel and other administrative budget reductions hopefully not impact employees as much as we can. We will try to protect our employees as much as we can, but this is a large reduction for our budget. We have been reducing our budget now over the last probably 6 years. I think our budget now has been reduced about 40%. So we have sustained significant and continual reductions in our agency budget.
Excuse me, would you say that number again?
I think over the last probably 6, 7, 8 years, we've probably seen our budget reduced probably 40%. I think when I first came to the legislature, the budget was probably in the $40 million range. And Ms. McGlone, our HR director is here. I may be over-exaggerating that, but it's been significant over the last few years. In addition to that, I wanted to also go over our governor's proposals. You asked about those. We will be proposing a $2.7 million increase in 2009 and then ongoing for our math and science academies and institutes. $1.5 million or so had been appropriated this last biennium, the biennium for our math academies. We want to continue that, plus enhance that with our math and science institutes. In addition to that, we have a $1 million request that would be ongoing for our Minnesota Virtual Academy. That would be for both teachers and students, so the teachers could acquire state-of-the-art online lessons or curriculum, and also look at any kind of additional professional development training that they could access online. And for our students, we would be looking at tutoring opportunities, credit course taking, many other kinds of opportunities for our students too. Then we are requesting $400,000 a year for our principal institute, leadership institute, that was funded the last biennium, and then unfortunately our request for ongoing funding was not appropriated. We have much support for that from a variety of people, from the higher ed institutions all the way through our K-12 educational organizations. We also are asking for the 2009 year, $250,000 to begin looking at an alternative pathway for licensure for teachers, and then would be ongoing at $1.75 million out into the future. And there would be, this would be an alternative pathway for mid-career changers and also people that have just acquired a degree in a content area, but who might be interested in going into teaching. The funding would allow participants to receive rigorous pedagogy instruction in relationship with their content area. There would be on-the-job mentoring that would be paid for, that would be very intensive, and ongoing evaluation throughout the year that would be funded with this type of money. We also are looking at a U-Teach program that's modeled after the University of Texas. Some actual legislators have visited the University of Texas at Austin. I forget who actually mentioned that the other day when we were in, I think, Representative Freiling's committee. This would provide some money for a higher ed institution to actually, for students who are in college and have not selected their major, who are math and science majors, to give them for them to take some free educational courses so that would expose them to the opportunity to teach. And the U-Teach program in Texas has been so very successful that about 75% of the students that participate end up going into teaching and stay after 5 years. Right now, our rate of retention is only about 50%. So it's a pretty good program, and we would like to see if it would take effect here in Minnesota. Then there are some miscellaneous, smaller appropriations. We are shifting some unused declining pupil, or not unused declining pupil aid, but some unused monies that had been appropriated for the flood down in the southern part of the state to the Rushford-Peterson declining pupil aid. We're kind of redeploying some of that money so that they continue to have some hold harmless monies for the result of the flooding in their district. We also have worked for the last 2 years with South Dakota on a reciprocity agreement. We have a number of border districts that where either South Dakota students come into Minnesota or Minnesota students go to South Dakota, and right now they have to negotiate their tuition agreements. And we've had several school districts that have not been able to negotiate a fair agreement with South Dakota. And I contacted the commissioner there, and I said, you know, we need to stop the fighting across the borders here. Let's make a fair agreement. And so this reciprocity actually just has some tail money for a hold harmless for some of our schools that might lose some money under the reciprocity. We don't want anybody to lose any money under this agreement. It's a very minimal amount of money, as you can see, $56,000 the first year and $62,000 the next year. We also are eliminating the cap on the CLEP exams. Those are exams that students can take for dual high school college credit. There's a cap of 6. We really feel like after this first year that the cap is unnecessary. There is money appropriately for these students, and we don't think the cap needs to happen anymore. There's some internal requests for our GED reimbursement rate. Right now, it's anybody who takes the GED test gets reimbursed $20, and we're just going to raise that to $40, but it's still within the same appropriation. There will be no increase in the appropriation, but to the extent that we can, you know, whoever wants to take a GED will now reimburse it $40 because the GED exam has gone up, and what we've been reimbursing has not gone up, but the appropriation is going to stay the same. We also needed some clarification of our, we've put the money into the Advanced Placement International Baccalaureate Program, and we just need carry forward authority. We have some of that money that's unexpended. We spend quite a bit of money in the summertime for teacher training in Advanced Placement International Baccalaureate, and so we have the money unexpended, and we want to make sure that those teachers are eligible for the rest of the money that's unexpended. And then I want to clarify, Ms. McGlone said that the 40% reduction to the MDE operating budget included the transfer of programs to DHS in 2003. So certainly when those programs moved over, that did reduce our operating budget substantially. So to be fair, it probably wasn't completely all, you know, that much of a budget cut to our agency, but still was significant over time. Then also there's just some clarification with the Minnesota State Academies that they will be allowed to use special education money for the cost of one-on-one aid. Dr. Melcher is here if you have some questions about that. And then also the instruction that they, like districts, should be trying to bill for third-party billing for their special education costs. Also, there was proposed, the governor is proposing to reverse a statutory operating debt aid payment shift. A few years ago, as you all know, our districts are paid on a 90-10 split. In other words, we hold back 10% of their funding so that if there's a change in their enrollment, we're not paying them more than what they're owed. And then when the enrollment figures are adjusted, then we pay the other 10%. Well, during our budget reduction times, we did do some shifting of that. In other words, we borrowed some money from the school districts and they had to do some borrowing. The one area that had a shift actually the other way was districts that were in statutory operating, that we let them keep 97% of their money, and they only had a 3% shift that we held back. And we're proposing to go back to just the 90-10 to adjust it and make it uniform with every other program that has the 90-10 payment schedule. This would result in a 6.1 savings to the state. And that I think covers, oh, we have utility transition aid also, and that is something that Dr. Meltzer maybe wants to come up and explain. I'm not as familiar with that one. Since we've adopted rule changes relating to utility property that will result in, in lower property tax values. And so any district or city that would get a lower property tax payment from utility payments, we would propose to provide aid so that they would be held harmless. Is that correct, Dr. Meltzer? Okay, and that would be $365,000 in 2010 and $600,000 in 2011. So that's a ways out. And if you want more details, so Dr. Meltzer can give you those details.
But that's a cost to the state.
That would be a cost to the state to hold the district harmless when there's a property tax value reduction.
Madam Chair.
Dr. Meltzer.
Tom Meltzer with the Department of Education. I just wanted to add that the utility piece was already included in the tax bill, which has been enacted.
Oh, okay.
And signed.
Okay. So we don't have to worry about that.
Right.
And, Madam Chair, that's the extent of our request for program funding this year, and then what the 4% reduction would do to our budget.
Commissioner, will you talk a little bit about the 4% reduction to your budget? You said that it was $892,000 and that 10 to 12 FTEs, but what you said you had to wait till after session to say for sure how that money was going to be reduced. Could you tell us any principles that you're going to use as guidelines as to how they affect the school districts and the children?
Well, certainly, as we're looking at budget reductions, we know that this is going to probably slow down our response time. If districts are calling, to ask for help or something, we just don't know at this point what areas and what divisions it will affect. But we do know that wherever they are, it will affect our ability to help school districts in a number of ways, whether it's just them calling in and asking for information or if it's, providing any kind of support out in the field as we go out to do that. But again, I don't know where where these reductions are going to fall. It's going to depend on, what passes here legislatively. If there are charges for us to create some new programs or task forces or different kinds of things that are unfunded and we have to fund those out of our existing budget, then that's going to affect how we then, fix things. What we are going to try to do certainly is to make sure that we're looking first at administrative areas, that we're looking at travel budgets, that we're looking at things that and attrition of retirement, if there are any retirements, so that we're not affecting people. We will try to do our best to keep it away from layoffs. And of course, we can't, even with the layoff process, that affects how, with bumping rights and everything else, it affects so many other things that it's very difficult for us to say at this point how it's going to all fall out.
Any other questions? Representative Heidgerson.
Thank you. Just a comment. We discussed this in K-12 finance also. For those of you that are new on there, the property tax shift on school districts that are in SOD, I think it's not a good time to be doing it. First of all, the Department of Education is already borrowing money from the school district by withholding 10% to get the next year. And this 97% has been in play for many years. And those are the school districts that are, if you look at the school districts that are in SOD, they're very, very poor school districts. So what you're basically telling them, we're not going to give you the 97 that we've been doing in the past, we're going to give you 90, so you have to go out and borrow some more. And I really think that, you know, when the state's in the budget, the crunch like that is bad enough, and then at the same time, when the school districts are already suffering, especially a few of them in the state, to do that is seems a little bit mean-spirited to me. Thank you.
Like kicking them when they're down, right? Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to also mention in your packet there is a PowerPoint that you can look at that has detail about the different proposals. And there's also a report from McKinsey that talks about top-performing countries and what they're doing as far as educational excellence. And one of the things that is in that kind of is overall, the whole report is talking about quality teaching. And we know that we're going to have between 40 and 50% of our teachers retire within the next 10 years. So part of the strategies that we're looking at is trying to look at our areas of shortage, trying to think of innovative ways to encourage people to come into the profession, and then also to come alongside of our teachers that are in the classroom right now and help them as we're changing our academic standards and requirements, helping them in the classroom with some professional development. And that's why you've got the two proposals, the academies for teachers on an ongoing basis, starting with math and science, and then also, you know, trying to look at some innovative ways to attract people into the profession. So just as background, those are some things for you. In your life, your time to read.
Right. And let me repeat that. 40 to 50% of teachers will retire in the next 10 years.
Yeah, if you look at the age range of our teachers now, and the teachers that are eligible for retirement within the next 10 or so years, we're going to see that eligibility. Now, they may not all retire, but we know that that's a pretty, you know, big chunk of folks that are going to be retiring, and those are some of our folks that are highly qualified, experienced people that we're going to lose, and we need to replace them. And the pipeline needs to be filled, just like it does for our science and math, our business industries. Same thing is going with our teaching, and we want to have the highest quality folks in the teaching profession as we've had in the past, and those folks are leaving. And we need to make sure that we replace them again, you know, with high quality folks.
Representative Heigerton, did I hear you say that you have a lifetime certificate?
Yes. Me too.
We have jobs for our retirement.
Yeah. Actually, Madam Chair, there is a proposal, I think, in the pension committee this year, which I think really makes a lot of sense, that would allow retired teachers to come back and teach. And right now, they can only make a certain amount of earnings before it's affecting their pension, and it's going to go up to, well, the proposal is, I think you could earn up to $46,000 without it affecting your pension, and I think that makes a lot of sense, because you could then teach part-time, fill in, especially in rural areas where you can't afford to maybe hire a full-time science teacher. You could, you know, hire a highly qualified, experienced person, and it wouldn't affect their retirement, so it's kind of a win-win.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that will pass.
At the next meeting, I think they're going to consider that.
Oh, no.
Any other questions for the commissioner? Representative Lawley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Segrin, as you know, we're all trying to put together this very difficult budget, the governor and the House and the Senate, and you are one of the very few areas that has a little bit of an increase, even though it's not much. Mm-hmm. What would happen if you didn't get any of it?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Slawick, I think that we would lose some momentum as far as, even though this is a small amount of money, I think it's leveraging a lot of capacity building in our state. The Principal Institute is an area where we know that the BCI schools that you read about have an extraordinary leader at the top, and I think this would start to slow down that momentum. We really know that with the requirements for our math and science standards to change, that we need to support our teachers as they're getting prepared for those changes. And I think that was very definitely put a hindrance in the ability for those teachers to be professionally developed. And I also think that we need to bring our educational system into the 21st century with online learning opportunities. And we need to use our technology in ways that so that we can actually create some equity within our state. We've got lots of people all over the state that can't travel down or up to the Twin Cities for all their professional development. And this would provide a way for us to get high quality teaching opportunities out to teachers too. So I think it would slow down our momentum that we have going and slow down the capacity building that I think we really need in this state to secure our future for the kids.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. The Office of Higher Education, small office. Welcome, Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Krista Grimes. I'm with the Office of Higher Education. The Office of Higher Education management team is still working through the process of deciding how to manage the cuts. The agency is trying to balance external stakeholder needs, statutory requirements, and the capacity of the agency. The supplemental budget would reduce $111,000 of the agency's administrative budget. The administrative budget altogether is $2.7 million, so this would be a 4% reduction. Director Susan Higard asked me to say that the $111,000 reductions will be difficult, but they are manageable and are not likely to result in reductions of positions. However, if budget cuts were a larger amount, that would result in, be likely to result in staff reductions. A rough estimate of areas likely to be affected is about $8,000 in employee development, such as professional conferences and training, $4,000 in agency memberships, $25,000 in printing, which would probably mean making more publications available online and eliminating some publications, $15,000 in computer technology and software, which would probably mean replacing hardware less often and delaying the purchase of software upgrades, $25,000 from the agency's accountability budget, which would probably mean one less survey to provide information on the effectiveness of Minnesota higher education, $5,000 in supplies and copying expenses, and $7,000 in travel within Minnesota and nationally. Now, those amounts are an example of what we're currently expecting, but we are still working through the process, so they won't be quite precisely that when we're all done. Without the $111,000, the agency will have less money for contingencies. The agency usually has some salary savings from employee attrition and turnover, and contingency funds left at the end of each year that is used for severance for retiring employees and special projects. In the past, the agency has used contingency funds for things such as upgrading our phone system to meet state agency standards, paying increased dues to the Midwest Higher Education Compact, more effectively providing online service to customers through new software and updating our computer servers, remodeling to save on rent expenses by moving our outreach staff, it's called Get Ready Gear Up, to the same location as our current offices, and providing funds to sign the state up for the e-transcript initiative that enables low-cost electronic transcripts to go from high schools to colleges and college to college when students are transferring. And one note of caution is that the agency will have to meet the 2008-2009 biennium salary increases within the current budget.
And the agency will be able to do that. That won't be part of the $111,000 cut.
It won't, no. That's not the plan.
And so the things that you mentioned won't have any, will not have any direct impact on students then, except for the transcripts?
Madam Chair, well, the transcripts are an example of what we've done with contingency funds in the past. That is correct. The goal is to try to keep the changes in places that will not directly affect students.
Any questions? Thank you very much. We can understand $111,000 better than the million. Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Ms. King.
chancellors. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you, and I'm delighted to be here. My name is Laura King, and I'm the Vice Chancellor for Finance and the Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Just in way of background, we don't get an occasion to appear before you very often, so if I might just take a moment and provide a little background. We educate more than 382,000 students a year in credit and non-credit courses, or about 64% of all Minnesota undergraduates. Each year we graduate more than 33,000 students, and more than 80% of them stay in Minnesota to continue their education or to go to work. We recognize that this is a difficult time for the legislature, and that MinSU and the University of Minnesota, as part of the state's budget process, are looked to be part of the solution. We understand that. But we must share with you today that we have some concerns about the size of the governor's recommendation. I'll start just by reviewing a few points about our financial background. Historically, state appropriations have covered about two-thirds of our cost of instruction, and the students have paid the remaining one-third. That changed in 2003 when our state appropriation was cut by nearly $50 million. In the next 2 years, it was cut by an additional $190 million, for a total of $240 million in reductions in 3 years. And we were forced through that to turn in part to double-digit tuition increases, which I know members were very concerned about, as was our board. Last year, the governor and the legislature gave us a generous increase. We finally got back near our 2002 funding level. We're not there yet, but we got close to it. And then we are now faced this year with a $26 million recommendation for a reduction. We believe that you provided the appropriation increase for us really with an expectation that we would pursue three strategies. The first was to lower tuition, keep tuition increases low. The second was to provide higher salaries. We've had some really tremendous competitive salary slippage in the last 10 years. It's important to us. You heard the commissioner talk about turnover and retirement. We recruit on a national basis for faculty, and it was very important to us to have a nationally competitive salary structure. And third, we know you asked us to expand some programs and services. There was a lot of discussion in both the House and the Senate about targeting our enrollment and recruitment and success efforts to the traditionally underserved and underrepresented students, and you provided us with some resources to do that. You also provided us with some resources to start rebuilding our technology infrastructure, which has not had any significant investment since the merger, really. With your help, we were delighted to bring a budget to our board that included recommendations that tuition increases would be held at 2% for the colleges and 3% for the universities. We just recently concluded faculty contract negotiations and were able to provide settlements there that started to respond to the concern we have about slippage. And we have made some very important strategic investments in the area of improving access and success for traditionally underserved students. These proposed budget cuts, of course, put all of that now at risk. At our board meeting tomorrow, we will start discussions with the board about actions to balance the budget. At this point, I can't say to you how we will do it. We know that we have four choices to pursue. The first one is to roll back the investments, to roll back the progress that we were hoping to make this year on some of the critical investments that we think are so important to the workforce of today and the workforce of the future. The second option would be to take a 4% cut to the system operating budget. That will show up in fewer services to our campuses, fewer program offerings, fewer new programs that respond to changing economic and industrial demands, fewer advising and counseling services, which go right to student success. A reduction of this size may well impact employees, as salaries are 75% of our budget. The third option would be to increase tuition beyond the recommendation that's in front of the board right now. It would take a 4% tuition increase to replace the $26 million reduction. We don't think that's an attractive option, but it's an option that we can't responsibly take off the table until we get to the end of the legislative session and understand what our financial condition is. None of these choices is attractive to us, and I would venture that none of them are attractive to you. There's no way for us to remove this much money from the budget without there being service consequences, without there being employee consequences, and certainly without there being impacts on the students. Last year, we asked for a $180 million increase. You supported us with a $150 million increase. Were this reduction to go forward as planned, it's an annual reduction to the base, so it doubles for the biennium. So our $150 million increase would decline then to $100 million. Those are very large cuts for us, Madam Chair. We are in conversations with our board, and we'll continue in conversations with your members as the session unfolds. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Slavik.
Just a quick one, Madam Chair and Ms. King. Being that you have is a $156 million increase that the legislature gave to you, is any of that unencumbered? There must be, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Slavik, the language you use refers to the state accounting system. It's all encumbered because it was all set aside for us. We in turn then get a block grant from the state finance department, and we distribute all of it to the campuses. We have 32 campuses, and we have an internal allocation process that sends all that money out to the campuses. They in turn make hiring decisions. They make program startup decisions. So no, there's nothing that's unencumbered sitting somewhere without a use attached to it. We do annual budgets, and that budget planning process has started, and we're now in conversations with the presidents about what things would they stop doing if they had to pull 4% out of their budget, but it will have an impact from somewhere.
Madam Chair.
Representative Slavik.
That is just something we're all looking at here.
Right.
If we're in the same position you are, you know, is what programs are kind of teed up but not off yet, and that we can...
Now we have nothing like that, ma'am.
Been to. Hmm.
Representative Slavik, nothing like that. We're a 12-month operation, and as soon as the budgets are approved by the legislature, we go into operation. So we are very planful. The board has a strategic plan and an action plan, and everything gets plugged in, and we're off and running.
Ms. King, talk about the 4% increase at central administration.
It would be our expectation that any reductions would happen both at central administration and, if necessary, in the college and university budgets as well. We staff a very substantial technology effort in the central office. We administer on behalf of all the colleges a uniform accounting system, a uniform payroll system, one registration system, one transcript system. It's a little unusual if you look around the country at other systems. We're way ahead in that regard. We've taken substantial administrative savings over the last 10 years since the merger because we have brought people onto a single platform. And we staff that out of the central services. So we would look for reductions in central services that would flow through to campuses because those services are provided on their behalf.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. King.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your interest.
University of Minnesota. I have been waiting for this day almost since the day I came to the legislature.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Richard Fitzenreiter. I go by Fitz for short, and I'm a CFO and treasurer at the University of Minnesota. And for those that Well, I will say I left the legislature in 1992 after working here for 10 years, and that's why I'm hoping Representative Murphy doesn't remember anything about anything I said.
I remember a project I didn't get.
I always upheld the House position in Conference Committee as well. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here representing the University of Minnesota, and I just want to tell this committee and assure this committee that great things are happening at the University of Minnesota, thanks to the very strong support that that the legislature gave us in the current biennium. We're making tremendous gains. We are concerned about the level of the cut and slowing our momentum down. We did have an increase in the fiscal year we're in now over the previous fiscal year of about $68 million. And then we hoped to have an additional incremental increase on our base for 09 of roughly $16.6 million. The governor's proposed reduction of $27.2 million wipes out that incremental next step in our appropriation and goes in and reduces about $10.7 million on that increase that we had for the current fiscal year. That increase was generous in this biennium. We freely acknowledge that. And the president has stated publicly that we know that we need to be part of the solution for the state's budget problem. We simply feel that the $27.2 million is too deep and too much at this point in the biennium. Our budget, if you go all the way back to fiscal 2001, when the beginning of the last recession in Minnesota and budget problems hit, our cumulative average annual increase in the university's budget has been averaged about 2.5%. That compares with the overall state budget growth during that same period of roughly 4.7%. So while the current biennium is a significant increase, and those numbers have been battered around biennium to biennium, it's a generous increase. You really have to look at it over time, and our average increase has only really been around 2.5%. As I said, we continue to have a major transformation at the U. Our applications, this is the sixth straight year that applications to the university are up, and we also have, again, one of our best prepared classes in our history. We've had, over the last several years, a very strong commitment to affordability. The president has made fundraising for scholarships and what he calls the Promise of Tomorrow scholarship plan, and it's raised roughly $210 million for endowments. We have a very innovative and we think best in breed founders free tuition program that provides significant financial aid out of the university resources for students that are Pell eligible. I do want to make sure and clarify the record that in the current academic year, thanks again to strong state support and in particular an innovation in the budget that was contained in the House bill that did survive Conference Committee from Representative Riccavina, in which the university and the legislature joined together to create a scholarship program for Minnesota resident undergraduate students with a family income up to $150,000. The tuition increase for those students in the current academic year on the Twin Cities campus was only 1.9%. University of Minnesota Morris in the current year, because of a tuition change we made, that tuition for those students actually dropped 10.3%. On the Christian campus, tuition went up 1.6% for those Minnesota resident students with the scholarship. In UMD, it was a 1.4% increase. Those increases affected roughly two-thirds of the students at the University of Minnesota, and that scholarship program also continues for the upcoming fiscal year, in which we hope to hold tuition to under 5% for the coming fiscal year. As I can echo from my colleague Laura King at Minsky, the university really has three choices as well. We can cut costs. Again, 70% of the budget at the University of Minnesota is people. So when we talk about reducing budgets and cutting people, if we took it all on people, it would probably turn out to be roughly 375 people off the budget through attrition and layoffs. As the president stated in front of a committee last week, this is really the wrong time and the wrong economy to lay off that many people, and it's not our preferred choice, but it is one of the choices we'll face. We can also defer investment. I know there was a question earlier, are there things that we haven't spent money on yet? And the answer is yes. We're in the process. We had that increase of $16.6 million in the second year of the biennium, and there are investments planned around that money, but it's not all out the door, so to speak, yet. One of the options on the table will certainly be to increase revenue, and that may well include tuition. We're not prepared at this point to say if the cut is $27 million, how much of that may have to come from tuition. It will be, as the President and the Board of Regents have said repeatedly, our last choice. We do not want to go there. We will look first at reducing costs and delaying investments, and then in the end have to look at tuition. We do face, and we know we will receive some form of budget cut, but we do face contractually through our labor contracts the promise of a compensation increase, and that compensation increase for our employees will cost us about $27.5 million for those employees just funded on O&M and tuition dollars. We have a commitment of $5.6 million for scholarships that we intend to meet. And we have facility costs, utility bills, debt, lease payments of roughly $6 million. As I said earlier, we think the $27.2 million cut is too deep. We do recognize that some level of reduction has to happen, and we're working closely with committees and members in hopes of reducing our overall cut to a more manageable level. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Fitz. I want to thank you for being honest about having funds that are unencumbered and so forth, because we know here at the legislature that is how budgets work, and we are looking at those because, you know, frankly, it's just easier if you have some money that hasn't been spent to at least try that. So I really appreciate you offering that up. What if you just cut that Driven to Discover campaign? How much does that cost?
Mr. Fitzgerald.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, we've allocated in the base budget about $1.5 million a year to the Driven to Discover campaign, and there's about another $400,000 of one-time money that was planned to go into it for next year.
Madam Chair.
Representative Slavik.
Editorial comment. You know, when we have kids that have less than straight A's in my district that can't even get into the U, it's hard to see those ads and know that our kids can't even go to the U, at least till they're juniors or seniors, so... for what it's worth.
Mr. Fitzgerald, would you save money by planting real grass on the university and the university building projects rather than artificial grass?
Madam Chair, are you referring to football practice facilities?
Perhaps. Or a stadium?
Well, Madam Chair, I'd have to defer to the turf management group at the university to answer that question.
The ones that get national attention for growing turf?
Madam Chair, from everything I've learned over the years, my understanding is that if you're going to use the athletic field a lot, it's less expensive to have the artificial turf than to have regular turf.
Are you going to put real grass around those new buildings that you're building with the bonding money?
Madam Chair, we appreciate open space on the campus, and I listen to those lawnmowers every day.
Real grass
summer.
Is really good.
I like it.
Representative Budd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And let me know if I'm repeating something that's been asked, but we talked a lot last session about the request from the university and whether we met it or not. If we met it, that we would be seeking tuition increases under 4%. There was this magic 4% number mentioned. And then fairly recently, we saw a headline that, you know, tuition was going up 7.5%. And you have presented some encouraging information today just now about increases in the 1% range, even a decrease at one Brookston, Morris, Twin Cities, etc., with those who meet the scholarship criteria. So I'd be interested in a little further clarification. I had asked to give us some feedback on this once we saw the 7.5% headline, because many of us have gone to our districts and say we gave them the amount they asked for, we're second in the state, 4% or below, and then we saw that headline. So what was the 7.5% referring to? And are you indicating that the 7.5% may have been the sticker price listed, but with those who were under the 150K family income, when you take account of the scholarship money, this is the net increase they experienced? If you could give us a little clarification about all that, so we know what the relation is.
Madam Chair, members. Madam Chair, members. First of all, I want to remind this committee that the Rukavina, the House's bill, was substantially better. I mean, significantly and substantially better than what came out of the conference committee. Out of the conference committee, the second year of the biennium was, compared to the House bill, substantially reduced. So the bill that, and the discussion that the university had with the legislature had a much lower tuition increase coming out of the House than ultimately happened in conference committee. But also the press, I'll be honest, and maybe it's just the university's fault for not banging the note constantly, but the press jumped from the 7.5 when even in conference committee we said that for those students meeting the eligibility requirements, their increase would be substantially less than 7.5. And we're trying and are trying to hold true to that for the second year of the biennium, even though the increase in the state appropriation was substantially less than the House bill.
Representative Biden.
Just to follow up for further clarity, the 7.5%, is that undergraduate only? Is that across all programs, including graduate programs, medical school? What does that apply to? And if it's not for the scholarship group, which I assume is undergraduate, who did get the 7.5%?
The 7.5% discussion was about undergraduate tuition. And because basically the tuitions for the graduate and professional schools tend to follow the market. So the law school may go up. The medical school hasn't been going up because they've been towards the top in the country. So all the discussion and focus has been on the undergraduate. And the people that are experienced or did experience the 7.5% increase in the current fiscal year, for on the Twin Cities campus, for example, were students who either didn't file a FAFSA, because that's our way of qualifying someone for the scholarship program, or had a family income above $150,000, or were non-residents, because that scholarship program was for residents.
Any other questions? Okay, we'll move on to the Thank you, Mr. Kitchenreiter.
Thank you.
We appreciate your input. Department of Employment and Economic Development, Commissioner McElroy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Dan McElroy, the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I'd like to briefly explain the budget with an emphasis on items that I did not discuss with you when I was here earlier to present the Governor's Seat Initiative. But the Governor's recommendation for our department can really be thought of in two parts. One, $11 million in new money from the general fund to make the investments in job creation on a statewide basis, but with some emphasis in greater Minnesota through an initiative called SEED, Strategic Entrepreneurial Economic Development. And then a number of reductions or transfers to create some resources both to help pay for that and to assist with the budget balancing. The largest is an $8 million transfer from the Workforce Development Fund to the General Fund on a one-time basis. The Workforce Development Fund is created by essentially an assessment on employers' unemployment insurance rates called the Workforce Development Tax. It's has the authority to carry over funds. It would, without this transfer, have a balance at the end of fiscal 2009 of $16.7 million. With this transfer, and assuming expenditures stay at or slightly above current levels, we'll still have a balance of $8.7 million. That assumes that we would continue to spend about $10 million a year on dislocated workers programs and continue to fund the local workforce development providers at a rate of about $14.5 million under current law. Essentially, we have had sufficient revenue to make this transfer on a one-time basis. We wouldn't recommend the transfer on a permanent basis, but we will still have a balance of about $8.7 million after that time. Governor's budget also recommends a one-time transfer from the 21st Century Mineral Fund of $2 million. There's currently a balance in the 21st Century Mineral Fund of approximately $40.35 million. There are commitments outstanding in that fund of $37,150,000, leaving an uncommitted balance of $3,201,000. We're proposing a one-time transfer to the general fund of $2 million, which would leave a remaining balance uncommitted of $1.2 million in the 21st Century Mineral Fund. There's also a one-time reduction in the Job Skills Partnership of $2 million, $1 million of which would be used to fund a proposal in SEED to provide additional Job Skills Partnership resources to our workforce centers on a statewide basis. And $1 million would be a reduction that would assist with the general fund deficit. There are also a number of smaller reductions, and I can go through those, Madam Chair, briefly. There's a $600,000 cancellation of a 2005 appropriation for the International Foreign Trade Zone. Very interesting appropriation, $750,000 to help provide incentives for Foreign Trade Zone. The first grant under it, the proposal was a feasibility study to see if the Foreign Trade Zone was workable. The consulting report came back that it wasn't workable, and therefore we're recommending that the event was not workable, that there wasn't a market for it at this time or in that place, that it's in the estimate of the consultant simply wouldn't work. And so it's our recommendation that we cancel the balance of that appropriation to the general fund, which is $605,000. We're also recommending a $150,000 cancellation of a revolving loan fund for methamphetamine lab cleanup. Since you did the meth bill in 2006 that outlawed ephedrine and pseudoephedrine, we haven't had a single application for funds under this program. And so would recommend that the remaining balance of $150,000 be canceled back to the general fund. We also are recommending a reduction of $280,000 from a general fund appropriation for the Extended Employment Program. This is a program that's funded at about $13 million, a combination of general fund and workforce development fund. It is a very good program. It assists providing supported employment for developmentally delayed, handicapped, and mentally ill workers. One portion of this reduction, $125,000, is from a program, a new idea, a wage incentive program that hasn't been embraced or hasn't worked very well. And then $155,000 in reducing some capacity for hours that weren't claimed during 2008 and that will reduce capacity in 2009. And I do have some program staff experts to answer more detailed questions on that. That's a $280,000 reduction of a program that's funded at approximately $13 million. That, Madam Chair, I think covers the recommendations in the governor's budget. I think you asked me, your staff relayed some fairly specific questions, one of them about changes we're proposing in the Job Z. Would you like me to go into those at this time, or would you like me to take questions, Madam Chair?
We have a question right now. Representative Grimes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner McElroy. I am going to focus in on the extended employment cut and the $125,000 wage incentive cut and take great exception to that. I can't imagine why we would, and no matter how desperate we were, we would want to cut employment programs for people with disabilities. And, you know, that's a great sign of recovery. It's very cost effective. And I know from when you and I served together on the audit commission that you and I both worked together to get some a topic that was important to people with disabilities. So I just can't imagine why in all the things you could be looking at, you would be looking at that. And as far as the wage incentives, new idea. It seems to me it's been beheaded before it hardly had a chance to even get out there. And I was asked by John Sherman to be a part of that study. I never heard back and wasn't. The head of Pass Unlimited, John Trepp, was planning to be part of it. He never heard anything. And so to me, it's very premature to be cutting something that hasn't had a chance to thrive. And, you know, wage incentives would be so that people with disabilities could earn good wages, and the programs that are providing those jobs that have good wages would have a little tiny incentive. I think we all know that $125,000 in the great state of Minnesota's annual budget is not a huge amount to ask for incenting a little teeny-weeny bit for those type of programs. So I'm certainly hoping that we don't make those cuts. That's a very small amount of money, and I think it would be penny-wise and very pound-foolish. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, rather than my speak about a program that I know some about but not as much as our staff, I'd like to ask Kimberly Peck, who is the director of this program, to comment on your concerns.
Ms. Peck. For the record, my name is Kimberly Peck. I'm the Director of Rehabilitation Services with SPEED. Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, I anticipated your questions and concerns regarding the wage incentive. You know, I wish that none of us were in a situation of having to make cuts. Wouldn't that be a glorious world to live in? In terms of how or why the decision was made to look at the wage incentive appropriation, there are a number of reasons, and let me do my best to clearly but succinctly articulate those reasons. First off, there is a wage incentive component to the extended employment rule, which allows us to provide incentives to providers who are providing jobs that pay good wages for individuals with disabilities. So that's already in the rule. The $125,000 that was appropriate in this last legislative session was above and beyond those dollars that we are, through the course of doing business, above and beyond what we were able to provide for wage incentives for providers. This wage incentive dollars does not eliminate jobs for individuals with disabilities. It does not eliminate good jobs for individuals with disabilities. Also, as part of the agreement with the appropriation of the $125,000, there was a request made to examine and evaluate the efficacy of the wage incentive component of the rule in moving employment opportunities for individuals with disabilities to those better jobs. That report was completed on January 15th, was provided to the legislature, and the conclusions of that report essentially say that the wage incentive programs do help maintain existing jobs at those higher wages, but they don't increase the availability of new jobs that pay competitive wage for individuals with disabilities. That really needs to come about through increased appropriation for supported employment and frankly, in my opinion, a transformation of the supported employment service delivery system, which is shared by DEED and the Department of Human Services.
Thank you, Ms. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm interested in a little bit more about the Job Skills Partnership Fund, and you alluded to the two places that you would be sending those funds. And I guess, first of all, I wanted to know the impact on the programs that have been, you know, that have been usually funded with the Job Skills Partnership Board of Directors. Making all those decisions. Did they make the decision about the transfer? What is their reaction? And then what's the impact on those programs that were funded through the partnership program? And how much money do they have left to work with, if any?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, the Job Skills Partnership gets money from two sources. They get a general fund appropriation of approximately $6.7 million a year. And we have the authority to transfer money from the Workforce Development Fund to the Job Skills Partnership and have some carry-forward authority. In 2007, we transferred $7.9 million from the Workforce Development Fund to the Job Skills Partnership. And of that, we have used approximately $1.5 million for a program called Special Incumbent Worker Grant. We're carrying forward about $6.4 million of workforce development funds into this program year, in addition to the $6.5 million approximately in general fund appropriation. We're proposing to use, to reduce the general appropriation by $2 million, of which $1 million would go to the general fund, and $1 million would stay in Job Skills Partnership, but for a new program, which would be job skills grants to smaller employers working through our workforce service area. Right now, there's a fair amount of paperwork involved in doing a Job Skills Partnership grant. It's a very competitive program. We're essentially proposing a program that we want to get to smaller employers, to employers with 5 to 25 employees, but who also need skills training, whether that's in manufacturing or service industry, but particularly the areas where there are good wage levels. And we, our solution to that, and it's provided for in the language of the SEED initiative, is essentially a grant to our 16 workforce service areas to do job training for smaller employers in their area. That's $1 million. The Job Skills Partnership Board that you referred to, which is a board appointed some by the governor and some by the House and the Senate, is supportive of the small employer grant. They were not asked whether they supported that $1 million, and I'm sure they will be disappointed. It is, as others have said, not easy choices when we have to cure a deficit. We will, however, have significant resources going into 2009, both because of the remaining appropriation and the transfer that was made from the Workforce Development Fund. And that transfer is in place prior to the proposal. Even with that transfer and the $8 million proposed to be transferred from the general fund, there'll still be a balance in the Workforce Development Fund at the end of 2009 of about $8.7 million.
Representative Peterson.
One follow-up question, and not particularly with that one, but also with the dislocated workers. It seems to me at a time when we have so many companies that are either downsizing or even leaving business, that whole issue of dislocated workers seems to be kind of a difficult area to cut. And I know you noted that they were cutting in that area. What's the impact with people who are being laid off and need to get new skills? Will we still be able to serve them?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, we're proposing to spend slightly more in 2009 than we spent in 2008, about $10 million on state services plus some money we get from the Federal Workforce Investment Act for dislocated workers. We have built up something of a balance in the Workforce Development Fund, and we will still have a balance of $8.7 million after these transfers. So if the demand for services was higher than anticipated, we could spend, in 2008, we'll spend about $9.6 million on dislocated workers, budgeting $10 million, but we'll have $8.7 million in additional funds in the fund if necessary.
Commissioner, on any of your transfers, are you from one fund to or offering up, are you going to create waiting lines?
Madam Chair, I don't believe so.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an area I know nothing about, but I'm just curious. So we've done transfers from the Workforce Development Fund to other related funds like the Job Skills Partnership. Have we done transfers to the general fund in the past to cover deficit problems with the general fund?
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I was looking for a fiscal analyst, but and I don't see Mr. Soderberg here. Yes, it was in, not in on Governor Plenty's watch, but on Governor Carlson's watch. There were transfers. It's been some time. But there have been transfers in the past, and I can get information to the details. I don't know that we do. Do we have those? Yeah. I think we have some information, but I think it was expenditures rather than transfers. There were significant transfers during the Carlson administration. We will check, Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, if there have been transfers since then. I don't recall any, but there may have been.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Again, I know very little about the Workforce Development Fund. Why do we maintain large balances in that fund? They run about a third of the income. This is, for the most part, income, or totally income is generated from the existing tax. Why do we maintain big balances from year to year?
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
The fund is to some extent countercyclical. Collections tend to go down if wages go down, and the need goes up if wages go down. So one way to look at it is as a savings account to be able to continue to provide services in times of increased need. And we're sensitive to that, but we're maintaining a balance of $8.7 million after this transfer. I wouldn't have supported a deeper transfer because we do need resources to continue to provide these important services. Minnesota is one of 12 states that has a state funding source for dislocated worker services, and it, I think, has yielded a return on investment on being able to make investments in workers who are dislocated and in keeping them in Minnesota, and that's a great thing. We have the balance is sufficient that we can make this transfer and still maintain $8.7 million at the bottom line at the end of 2009.
And that leads to my final question. Of course, you don't have a crystal ball any clearer than mine, but I would, if current trends continue as are, we don't know, I would imagine that fund would come under heavy use in the coming fiscal year. Would that be your expectation as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, we are providing we're estimating that there'll be an increase in need from about $9 million to about $10 million in dislocated workers programs plus our federal resources. But we have a bottom line, we have a balance if it's higher than that. But yes, we think there will continue to be layoffs where dislocated workers need services.
Thank you.
Commissioner, do you anticipate that the Minnesota Minerals 21st Century Fund will be paid back in the future?
Madam Chair, the governor's position is that we should appropriate money for that as we have projects that need funding, and that we should, as we have done in recent years, as Itasca County and others have needed resources for projects like Franconia Minerals or Minnesota Steel, and so that it should, to some extent, be a pay as the need arises rather than maintaining a large balance. And the governor's position would be if future projects develop where resources are needed, he'll recommend an appropriation.
So the answer is no, unless there's new development.
Madam Chair, we are not proposing any automatic repayment, but I would be advocating that we recommend an appropriation if, as for projects like Polymet or Duluth Minerals or Tech Cominco or others may develop to create good-paying jobs and take advantage of the mineral resources, or if the Kimberlite prospects in places like Aiken and Kennebec counties develop, we may be back seeking appropriations for this fund in the future.
Are there any other questions? If not, thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, at this point, I would love to move the minutes from March 10th of this year.
Representative Mariani moves adoption of the minutes of March 10th as printed. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment the motion is adopted. That brings us to the end of our agenda and the end of our mission. And thank you so much for staying on this afternoon, and almost all of you are here all afternoons when we have met. I really appreciate it. From beginning to end, I appreciate it. I appreciated your input and your cooperation in whatever agenda has been before you. It's been a joy for me. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.